Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Randolph Avenue in Maida Vale, W9. Two streets south of the arrest of Edward Wellstrom Lewis. 100 feet east of the frozen torso of Hannah Brown. And two roads west of the unsolved murder by a killer who claimed to be the real Ripper. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Nestled to the side of Little Venice, Randolph Avenue is a quiet, discreet, and impressively clean road, lined with an odd mix of building styles, reflecting its ever-changing fortune over the centuries. Not too long ago, it was full of run-down council tenements. But today, it's mostly full of celebrities. But aside from featuring in the comedy A Fish Called Wanda, where Otto, played by Kevin Kline, sideswipes a car and shouts the immortal line,
"Asshole!"
You'll have no reason to know this street. At 7 Randolph Avenue, currently sits a 5-storey townhouse worth £6 million. And although the loft and the white Doric columns around the door are recent additions, it looks as it did in the 1960s. Back in 1964, the ground floor flat was the home of 77-year-old Samuel Bragg, a war veteran who suffered with dementia and lived in squalor. Thankfully, living in a house full of caring neighbours, when he needed help, they were always there. Right up to the day that he passed away in his bed. It's a sad story which happens every day in every town. Only Samuel's seemingly peaceful death would lead to his killer's arrest. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 169. Samuel Bragg. The Miser's Demise. Befitting a man who lived by himself, little is known of Samuel's life. Born in 1887, Samuel Bragg was the youngest of four to Henry and Eliza Bragg of Union Street in Lambeth, South London. A working-class family, with his mum a housewife and his dad a sawdust dealer. Age 14, he left school, becoming a building site labourer until he enlisted to fight for king and country in the First World War. And that is all that was recorded about the life of Samuel Bragg. It's as if his past had never existed, and his present was coming to a close. In March 1955, age 67, Samuel Bragg had moved into the small front room on the ground floor of 7 Randolph Avenue in Maida Vale. A council-run lodging, with Mr. Rosen, a 60-year-old bachelor living on the first floor, Mrs. de Troc, a 75-year-old widow on the second floor, and on the third, the Cotter family, comprising of Mother Kathleen, Father Timothy, and 3 children, Jean, Anthony, and Timothy Jr. Concerned for his well-being, the tenants always kept tabs on old Samuel, as it was clear that he had no one. With no wife, no kids, no friends nor siblings to visit him, Samuel was very much a loner. The sadness was that he had not always been this way. As a little guy of just 5 foot and 3 inches high, with a fondness for felt hats and sporting an elegant moustache, he was clearly once a bit of a dandy. But with no one to care for and no one to love him, Samuel had become a shadow of his former self. Isolated, lonely, unloved. Through his twilight years, this dapper gent had morphed into a ragged sack of bones. Infected with bed sores, his eyes sunken, and his skin unwashed and stinking. With his days spent alone in his squalid room, wearing soiled pants and muttering to himself in a rambling mumble. As a vulnerable man with advancing dementia, the welfare service had tried to get him a cleaner and a carer over the years, and to coax him to move into a nursing home. But he had always refused any help. Samuel lived the life of a miser, saving every penny, spending nothing, and living in abject squalor. Set to the side of the front door, his single room, being just 15 feet wide, consisted of a bed, a chair, 2 chests of drawers, and a small hob for cooking. With just 1 window, which was never open, the stale stench of this depressing hovel remained in semi-darkness, as he was too tight-fisted to switch on the bare bulb above his head. Being too mean to buy a rug, his calloused feet crept on the icy cold floorboards. And unwilling to waste money on coal, the soiled sheets of his bed was his only warmth. It was a room of utter sadness. There was no colour, no music, and no joy. In no part of this dingy filth lay family photos, love letters, or fond memories of his past, as all it contained was just the basics. And although malnutrition had made him weak, his spendthrift ways had made him live on a diet of sardines and potatoes, the cheapest foods he could buy. As every day, his mental and physical health would decline. Samuel had no one to love him. But there was one person who cared. On the third floor of 7 Randolph Avenue lived 40-year-old Kathleen Cotter, a busy mother of 4 who earned an honest crust as an office cleaner, as her husband's wage as a labourer wasn't enough. The Cotters had lived there for 12 years, and they had known Samuel since the day he had arrived. Initially, he was liked. But as his illness progressed, and the peculiarities of his dementia surfaced, some of the tenants grew distant. When they were little, Kathleen's youngest boys, Timothy and Anthony, often popped down to see old Samuel. He was fun, he was kind, and although tight-fisted, he always had a few pennies to spare so the kids could buy sweets. In the later years, although the promise of coins would prove a powerful lure, Tim and Tony stopped visiting, as in their words, the room stank. As a mother with a big heart and lots of patience, Kathleen did what she could for Samuel. She made him hearty meals, she darned his tatty clothes, and she even washed his bed sheets, as he often stayed in bed for days at a time. So rancid were his bed sheets that although she ball washed them separately as to eviscerate the lice, she would have loved to have burned them, only she knew he wouldn't buy more. In 1962, Kathleen was so worried about Samuel that she called the welfare officer. He was taken to St. Mary's Hospital, and having remained there for 5 months, when he returned home, he looked well. But within weeks, being back in the squalid stench of his own festering filth, Samuel began to decline. He got thin, pale, even more confused, and now, rejecting any help, he just wanted to be left alone. On the odd occasion that he ventured outside, he could often be seen wandering the streets in a pair of soiled underpants, mumbling to himself, unable to recall who he was or where he was going. Inside, his conversation was limited to just yes or no answers, and his hygiene was non-existent. He rarely bathed, his clothes smelled bad, and he would urinate into a metal bucket, which he kept beside his bed. With a communal toilet on the first floor, waking every day at 5:30 a.m., Samuel would ascend the stairs, nab Mr. Rosen's newspaper, and spend the next 20 minutes straining all manner of unpleasantness from his upset bowels. And when his symphony of rectal explosions was over, with shaky hands, he would empty his bucket, often missing the bowl and slopping his fetid waste over the seat and the floor. It wasn't malicious, and she knew it. So without any complaint, his mess was cleaned up by Kathleen. As his illness got worse, Samuel's paranoia turned to the only thing he had in his life: his money. Samuel was a miser. He wasn't mean. He was just terrified of being robbed and left with nothing. Everyone knew that Samuel had money, as on the days when he couldn't pick up his pension, Kathleen would collect it for him. Being held in a tin box in the third drawer down in his chest of drawers, the tin was always fastened, the drawer was kept locked, and the key was fixed to a chain on his belt. But as a frail old man, for any passing thief, he was an easy target. In January 1964, 7 months before his death, Samuel had £26 stolen from his tin. With the front door left open, and being too mean to fix the lock to his room, having left his trousers on the bed, the keys were used, and within seconds, the money was stolen. With the thief apprehended by Mrs. Cotter, as Samuel didn't want to report it to the police. The criminal agreed to pay back the full amount at a rate of 10 shillings a week. And that's what made the flats at 7 Randolph Avenue such a nice place to live, as the tenants always looked out for one another. Tuesday, the 14th of July, 1964, was the last day that Samuel was seen alive. For the last 3 weeks, he had been bedbound. His breathing was laboured, and his body was weak and pale. It took Kathleen a little off guard to see him upright and alert, as she knelt scrubbing the steps, her mind distracted by a set of keys to the office she cleaned, which had gone missing the day before. But there he was. Alongside Mrs. Dutruc, Kathleen asked,
"Mr. Bragg, you're feeling okay?"
Standing in the doorway of his unlit room, dressed in a stained pair of pajamas, he croaked,
"No, I'm not."
His face all long and drawn.
"You really ought to see a doctor,"
Mrs. Dutruc begged. But just wanting to be left alone, the old man muttered,
"The doctors can do nothing for me."
And with that, he returned to his bed. The next day, Kathleen gave her son Timothy £1 to buy some bread and milk. Being a typical 14-year-old boy, his teenage years had made him a little selfish. So having taken 3 shillings of her change, roughly £1 a day, he had spent it on pinball machines at the Phoenix Club, a youth club in West Hampstead. It had been fun, but knowing how hard she worked and how disappointed she'd be, at 10:30 p.m, as he came in,
"I heard old Samuel moaning. I didn't pay attention, as he was always like that. Besides, the room smelt of wee."
And worried about how he was going to apologise to his mum, Timothy passed Samuel's room, ascended the stairs, and returned to the family flat on the third floor. On Friday the 17th of July, 2 days later, Kathleen had grown worried. Having entered the communal toilet at 7:10 a.m, she prepared herself to reel from the toxic horror of the old man's ablutions. Only it was as clean as she had left it the day before. Which was odd, as Samuel was a man of routine, even when he was ill. Kathleen would state,
"I went down to his door. It was as it was. It was wedged shut with a piece of paper. I listened outside and heard nothing. I pushed it and went in. The bed was behind the door. All I could see of him was an arm over the top of the sheet, outside the covers. His head was turned towards the wall, and there was a pillow over the side of his face. I lifted it up and saw he was dead."
PC Horace Sims arrived at 8 a.m, followed by the police surgeon, Dr. Samuel Sanders, who declared the life of 77-year-old Samuel Bragg extinct. With no signs of forced entry and nothing obviously stolen, robbery was ruled out. The room was messy, but no more than usual.
and with his skin mottled with a mix of old and new bruises. This wasn't seen as suspicious, as the elderly often bruise a lot easier than the young. With no signs of struggle or assault, the most likely cause of death was the accidental suffocation, as his pillow had blocked his airways as he slept. His body was removed by J.H. Kenyon, an undertaker, and taken to St. Pancras Mortuary, where Dr. Molesworth Johnson confirmed death by accidental smothering. With no loved ones, no close family, and no relatives left to mourn him, the body of Samuel Bragg was held at St. Pancras Mortuary until someone either claimed him or paid for his funeral. And with that, the inquest was closed. It was nothing extraordinary, as being something which happens on most streets, in most towns, on most days. The death of Samuel Breck was just another sad demise of an old lonely miser. The tenants at 7 Randolph Avenue went back to their regular lives. The council had the room fumigated. His few possessions were destroyed, and a new lodger moved into the ground floor flat. Kathleen never found her missing keys. Timothy paid back the 3 shillings he had taken, and the toilet remained mercifully clean in the preceding weeks, although a sadness still hung over the house. As often happens, some of the tenants spoke of how weird Samuel's death was, of how the messiness of his room wasn't quite right, of how he had bruised himself, only he hadn't left his bed. And even Kathleen would inform the police, "I think old Samuel's been done in." But with no evidence of foul play, the police knew, as often happens, that people often clutch at straws when they're struggling with grief. One week later, on Wednesday the 22nd of July, Kathleen was enduring the typical day of a harassed mother. Being home for lunch, 14-year-old Tim and 15-year-old Tony were bickering as usual. Their flat was too small for a family of 6, and with the boys sharing bunk beds, they often got on each other's nerves. With lunch finished, she was trying to wash up the dishes when she heard her boys in the other room getting in each other's faces.
"Boys, quit!"
she barked, knowing they were due back at school any moment, and with Tim off on his paper rounds soon enough. With the quibbling siblings split, the flat would soon become quieter. From the front room, Tony called out,
"Mom, he's hiding something!"
Dobbing his younger brother in like a massive SWAT. Only Tim was adamant.
"I'm not, Mum. I'm not hiding nothing."
Their father, a former heavy drinker, was more of the disciplinarian, whose fast smacks could silence any nonsense. But their mother would be the first to admit that she was often a little too soft on her boys. Especially Tim, as although bright, he was often bullied for wearing thick glasses owing to a squint. Their bickering continued.
"Mom, he's hiding something in his jacket."
"Boys, quiet down."
"Mom, I'm not. He's lying."
"Okay, enough now."
"I can, Mom. I can hear it jangle."
"Come on,
he's lying.
Prove it. Give me your jacket."
"Off. Mom!"
But it was the next sentence which stopped Kathleen in her tracks.
"He has, Mom. He's got some keys!
For a whole week, she had searched for her keys. She'd looked everywhere, and she had asked everyone. But nothing had been found. And now, furious at his little joke, the fun and games were over. With a look only a mother could give, the kind which makes all boys' bits shrivel, she barked,
"Hand me back my work keys."
Timothy froze.
"Hand me back my work keys. Now."
But still he didn't move, as the only movement was a single tear which trembled on his lid. But Kathleen was not joking.
"Timothy, keys. Now."
Unwilling to put up with his shit anymore, Kathleen snatched his jacket off the chair. She reached inside his pocket. And as was expected, with a distinctive jangle, she pulled out a set of keys. Only these were not Kathleen's keys. And as she held them, her face became etched with horror.
"Timothy, what are you doing with Samuel's keys?"
She didn't want to think it. She daren't. But as her youngest son began to cry, there seemed to be only one answer, and it was the unthinkable. Unsure what to do, Kathleen sent him back to school while she discussed it with his father. At 4:30 p.m., a little later than usual, he sheepishly returned, grabbed his bike, and headed out on his paper round. It was a part-time job he had been doing since January, and earning £1 a week. 10 shillings he kept for himself, and the other 10 shillings were paid on a weekly basis to Samuel. Back then, his mother had protected him. As being a good lad, she had begged Samuel not to go to the police. And a local probation officer had arranged the repayment of the £26 he had stolen. But this was different. This was murder. At 7:15 p.m., Timothy returned home to 7 Randolph Avenue. For Kathleen, it was possibly the hardest decision that any mother would ever have to make. But she knew it was right.
"Tim, you know what we've got to do, don't you?"
she calmly cooed. And he did. With a quivering lip, Tim cried,
"Yes, Mum. I won't hold it against you if you turn me in."
And as he dressed, she said that he cried bitterly. It was only a 10-minute walk down the Edgware Road, but it would be the longest walk of their lives. At 8:30 p.m., Kathleen and Timothy Cotter arrived at Paddington Green Police Station. As this devoted mother and son stood quietly holding each other's hands. Interviewed by Detective Superintendent Howlett, the DS asked the boy,
"Your mother's told me she found Samuel Bragg's keys in your pocket, and that you told her you may be the cause of his death."
Timothy nodded, and he was cautioned. In a brief confession, he would state,
"I went into his room to get some money. I took his keys off his trousers, and as I was looking through his drawers, Mr. Bragg woke up. I panicked.
I picked up the pillow. I held it there for about 1 or 2 minutes. He was breathing when I left him. I know he was.
Those words were Timothy's own. But as he was still only a child, his confession had to be countersigned by his mum. Except for the keys, nothing else was stolen. But as he sat there, the boy's motive became obvious. As Tim would cry,
"I stole 3 shillings of your change, Mum. I'm sorry. I wanted to make it up to you."
That evening, as no relative had claimed Samuel Bragg's body, a second autopsy was conducted at St. Pancras Mortuary to determine if this was in fact not a case of accidental smothering, but of murder. As before, his injuries were consistent with accidental asphyxiation. There were no signs of assault, no evidence of manual or ligature strangulation, nor any obstruction to the airways. But given that the man was old, frail, and weak, the pathologist deduced that it was perfectly possible for a boy to press a pillow over the old man's face for 1 or 2 minutes and to induce unconsciousness and even death. This kind of injury would have ordinarily have caused bruising to the lips. But as Samuel had taken out his false teeth, no bruising had occurred. On Wednesday, the 22nd of July, 1964, following a further investigation and a second autopsy, in the presence of his mother, 14-year-old Timothy Cotter was charged with the murder of Samuel Bragg. To many, Timothy Cotter was a harmless young boy who made a mistake to pay back his mum. But as his story came out, the more people talked. Many people knew he had stolen £26 from Samuel. But what only a handful of people knew was how much the old man was worth. Had Timothy found the right key, he'd have seen that the cash tin contained an assortment of notes and coins worth £30, and a post office savings book with a credit of £3,400, almost £67,000 today. Some may blame his friends, but others would state that Timothy had a dark side. As a few days after the murder, he relayed the facts of his burglary to a pal, with the cool calmness of a career criminal. Dr. P.D. Scott conducted a psychological assessment of Timothy, who stated,
"This boy is of superior intelligence. He displays a callousness towards his victim and admits to stealing to feed his new tastes,
buying records, fancy clothes, and going out to dances.
He has regretted the offence largely because of its implications to himself, rather than because of sympathy for his victim. The only hint of violence is his fantasy in his depiction of how he would deal with homosexual men in cinemas,
stating,
I would slam them or stub them with cigarettes."
Tried on the 8th of September 1964 at the Old Bailey, he pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of manslaughter, and the jury accepted this. On the 15th of September, 14-year-old Timothy Noel Cotter was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Upon hearing this, his face was emotionless. Unlike his mother, who was in floods of tears.
Thank you. Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
cough, cough, splutter. Oh, I coughed and coughed all the way through that. That was a hard one to do. I think my, because of all the coughing I've been doing, I can't hear right in my ears, so I've no idea. I can just about hear myself today. My hearing just went, really weird just before I started recording. Oh, one day I will get well again. Hey, folks, it's Extra Mile. So before we dive into Extra Mile, I've got a little treat for you, a little treat for you to enjoy. So 2 days ago at the weekend, Mark and Beth Ann from the Seeing Red podcast invited me onto their show. We had a really lovely morning. We did a couple of podcasts together. While I was there, I said to them, hey, guys, how about... I was like, can I ask you some questions as well? And then I'll play it out on Murder Mile. So what I did was I did them a series of questions, which I didn't tell them about in advance. So they've never heard these answers. And I think it gave for a really interesting interview. It's interesting questions about murder, which helps you explore more about who they are. And they came up with some great answers. So we're going to play that now. Enjoy it. And then after that, we're going to do Extra Mile. Enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a very exciting interview this week. Oh, I say this week, it's like I rarely do interviews, but this is exciting. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Beth Ann and Mark from Seeing Red.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, everybody. Hello. That was a lovely introduction. I feel special.
I scripted it. I've been rehearsing that all week.
That would explain it.
Oh, yes. I feel very honoured. Thank you for having us.
I should really have done
it. It's not one of those. It's not too late to put sound effects in the edit.
I'd do it. Well, with you guys, what I'll do is I'll do little farty sound effects.
That's always good with us. We love that kind of humour.
Wonderful.
We
love
it. So, lovely to tell us about your show, guys.
So we are Seeing Red, a true crime podcast. I reckon we're coming up for 4 years, I think, aren't we, Bethan?
We are, nearly 4 years.
So we are probably, I don't know, 160, 170 episodes deep. We've been on a real journey with it from the beginning to where we are now. So, yeah, each week we choose a different crime. We take it in turns to tell the other about said crime. And kind of chip in with our thoughts around it. And we were quite heavily UK focused for the first 100 or so episodes, I guess. And now we've broadened our horizons and we cover crimes from all over the world. So we've covered everything from the murder of Jill Dando which obviously happened in London, right through to the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the brother of Kim Jong-un, which happened in, I can't even remember where it was now, Bethan. Fascinating episode.
Was it Thailand?
No, it was...
I think Thailand.
Kuala Lumpur? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, in the airport.
It was in the airport, yeah. So, we just take it in turns to tell each other about a case that we find particularly fascinating. And, we're still loving it all these years later.
And we kind of find it fun because we can have conversations, even though it's still quite factual and sensible and scripted. We can have a bit of back and forth around some of our theories and our thoughts. And it's really good fun, actually, to kind of discuss the cases in a little bit more detail and get someone else's opinion, because quite often we'll differ in our opinions or differ slightly even, or we'll have a different take on something. And it's quite fun to bounce off each other with that.
Yeah.
And for listeners, what's a go-to episode? What's your favourite?
Oh, if you want to hear us being a bit irreverent, then the Peru 2, because that's quite fun. And I think a lot of people will understand that it can be a bit lighthearted. So Peru 2.
I'll just explain what that one was about. So that was Melissa Reed and Michaela McCollum. So they were the two drug mules that were allegedly recruited by this gang to carry drugs from Peru back across to Europe, and it was all bullshit. They'd done it for a few grand, and we sort of had a bit of a laugh at their expense, really, because I think it was valid. And that's a crazy episode. I think I might have mixed some painkillers with some other pills during the recording. So definitely a fun one.
There's some definite one-liners from Mark in that one.
I don't know what I was thinking. That's a great go-to, though. You're right, Betham.
I think that's quite fun if you want to see us in like a less serious side. And then there's quite a few that are very serious, but maybe something like Hillsborough maybe would be quite a good one to see us having a conversation, but from more of a serious side of things.
Yeah, I tend to find with any... any huge crime, any massive disaster, that's really Bethan's domain, and Bethan's covered numerous cases like Hillsborough, and always covers them so sensitively. And there's so much in a case like that we can't possibly cover even 1% of it in an hour long episode. But Bethan is great at honing in on some individual stories and victims, and really telling it from their point of view. So they're always the very harrowing episodes, those large scale crimes. So we've covered terrorist attacks as well, like the 7/7 bombings. That was another one for me that resonated and just stayed with me so much.
Super. Well, to both of you, I haven't sent you these questions, so this is going to be great. I've written a series of questions.
I'm so nervous.
The aim with these is to learn more about you through these questions. So let's get ready. First question. So obviously you two know each other really well. How would you murder each other?
Oh, Jesus.
What would be the
I'd
most...
I'd drug him.
What was that?
I'd just drug him. He would drink anything I put in front of him, so I could quite easily slip a poison into anything he was going to drink.
Awesome.
I think, yeah, if if Bethan told me it was an alcoholic beverage, it would be down the hatch, and I'd die to regret it later.
I didn't really have to think.
I'm worried about this.
Much,
I'm worried because this means
that was quick.
You thought about this.
Sorry, that was far too quick, wasn't it? That was too quick.
Before I give my answer on that, I just kind of slightly on this same topic. I do sometimes think that me and Bethan would actually make a great double act of committing a crime because we know so much.
Yeah.
And I think particularly if it were around robbery, I think we'd or pulling off some massive kind of con, I think we'd absolutely nail it. So I reckon that a bit more thought. In terms of murdering Bethan, it would have to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, I don't want to get in on a murder, by the way.
No,
we don't want to do that. I'll get in on a con, but not a murder.
I think for murdering you, Bethan, it would have to be some kind of bloodbath, because I'd want it to be featured on an episode of a true crime podcast. Maybe Mike could pick it up. We could travel to London. So I think some kind of like abattoir type setting, using some of the implements to hack her to pieces, and she'd have to end with a good old-fashioned beheading, I think.
Maybe a chainsaw?
A chainsaw. Heck. Mike, this is perfect. Thank you. I'm going to make some notes.
Hang on. Am I dead before you start doing this? Or
I don't know. I mean, perhaps. We'll see on the day, won't we?
Have I just ruined seeing red?
I'm not doing it anymore. I'm gone.
Yeah, this ain't going to happen anymore. At least she said she was only going to drug me. That's, you know, I can deal with that. I'm really going to go to town on Bethan if it ever happened.
Yeah, but the drug could be cyanide, and you could be gagging on really horrible hydrochloric acid. So it could be a really painful
death.
That's
true.
It's going to be now that I've heard what he wants to do to me, it's going to be very painful, don't you
worry?
Well,
it's going to be some kind of nerve agent, I reckon, because with the Kim Jong-nam episode, obviously he was kind of drugged and he had this liquid sort of poured over his face. And, you know, it was an awful way to die. He's defecating himself at the airport and... kind of drowning in his own blood from the inside. It was appalling. So, yeah, a drug death isn't always an easy death. That's my motto, and I'm sticking with it.
Cool. Aren't you glad I asked that question?
No.
Terrified now.
See, we've learned a lot about you already. So, okay, you've alluded to the idea that you would make great serial killers, but... men have a tendency to, as serial killers, to only last about 2 years. Women tend to last 9 years. So how long would each of you last as a serial killer, and what would trip you up?
See, the thing that I always find fascinating is when somebody can't help themselves by blabbing. And I reckon that would be Mark.
No, it would not.
I'm sorry to not answer about myself, but I reckon you'd just be like, do you know what? I haven't had enough notoriety yet. I'm just going to send one letter to a paper just to get a bit more interest.
You are right.
And I'll be like, no, Mark, no, don't do it. Don't do it. And you'd be like, oh, no, babes, don't worry. It'll be fine. You'd send the letter. It'd have your fingerprint on. We'd get caught.
The problem is, what's the point of going to all that trouble if you're not going to get some sort of notoriety at the time? So, yeah, I think I was kind of like, no, I wouldn't do it. But you're right. The minute you mentioned a letter to the local newspapers or something, I was like, yeah, that's so me. So, yeah, you're probably right, Beth. And I wouldn't last 2 months, I don't think.
Probably a selfie as well.
Yes. Yeah,
I think you're like a silent assassin almost. So I think you'd just kind of really feast upon being more and more depraved. So I think eventually you would probably put the desire to kill before anything else, and you might just fuck up with some of the evidence, leaving that.
Oh, and get sloppy.
Yeah, I think you might get sloppy. I think you just get drunk on the feeling of killing. I think that's very you, isn't it? So,
Or just drunk.
Yeah. Very interesting question. Hopefully we never have to find out for real, but there's still time, I guess.
Wow, so neither of you would last that long.
I don't think we would, no, unfortunately. How long would you last, Mike?
Less than a day.
Really?
I've already thought about this. I would be so remorseful. I'd be so upset that I would probably write a letter to the victim's family saying, I'm really sorry about what I've done. I'm going to the police station. I'm full of guilt all the time. Being raised a Catholic, that's the problem. Like, full of guilt.
Yeah, 100%. That will be that, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, impossible, isn't it? Here's one. If the press were going to give you a serial killer nickname, what would it be? Now, mine, just to give you an idea, mine would be the Ditherer. Because I'm really shit at making decisions.
Oh dear. I feel like I would need a week to think of the best kind of name that I could come up with for myself. It'd probably be something really boring. I don't know. The Bristol Basher.
I think mine would kind of... Oh, that's so
we'll
good.
We'll take it.
I can't think of what mine would be properly. I'll have a proper think, but I feel like it'd be something like on a play on words about like baking a cake or something, because I feel like they'd pick up on something that I'd done nice, that was like I'd made a cake for someone, but then also murdered people. So I don't know if it'd be something like that, but I'm not really sure.
It's always those weird things, isn't it? The press always pick up on something obscure and you just go, why have you done that? Like, I've got one coming up, an episode coming up soon about the Angel Delight killer. Angel Delight Keller, he was briefly a model for Angel Delight years ago.
He doesn't kill anyone with Angel Delight.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
I know.
Angel Delight has nothing to do with it. It was just something from his past.
Literally, he is the face of Angel Delight. They changed the branding once. They put his face on the front cover because he has an angelic face. And that's it. So he became the Angel Delight Killer. And you just go, why? Are you lazy bastards? Have you got no brains in order to create a great story?
I'm a massive fan of the TV series Columbo. And I always think, knowing the Columbo episodes inside out as I do, and the kind of crimes the murders that would present themselves in that show, obviously I know this is fiction before anyone says it's, you do know that's not true crime. I know it's fiction. But I actually think a great story would be a true crime podcaster sort of getting obsessed with the trade of it and going out and trying to commit the perfect murder, perhaps, thinking that they're the expert and they could get away with it. So I think there's potentially something in that. It could happen.
I think that's it, isn't it? I think a lot of, we read a lot of stuff and we think, oh God, we'd be great at this, but I don't think which interestingly brings us on to the next question. Realistically, could you kill someone? Realistically.
I think we've debated that, haven't we?
I don't think I could. I think it would have to have been heat of the moment. You've just done something to someone really close to me and I react. I think that's the only way. I just don't think I could bring myself to take another life in any other situation. I don't think that any amount of money could lure me. I don't think any amount of power. I just can't see that ever happening, unless it was a case that something has just happened and you're in front of me and I grab the first thing and hit you or shove you or whatever it is. But no, I don't think I could premeditate anything.
It would be a snap, wouldn't it?
I think it would have to be for me. I'm quite a good liar at I think I could be quite a good liar, but I don't think I could then lie about something like that.
I don't know. I think you
to get away with premeditated.
I think you could, Bethan. I think your Bethan is really cool and collected and calm under any pressure. I always
call her a freak,
and I always used to when we worked together in particular, but I still call her a freak once a week. And the reason I call you a freak is because you just don't, you don't appear to worry about the normal stuff that lots of people worry about. And you don't ever really get nervous as well. And I would try and goad Bethan and sort of be like, oh, don't you feel nervous about this thing that's coming up or whatever? And she'd be like, no, I'm really excited about it. And I'd be like, for fuck's sake, you're an absolute freak. This is not normal. So I think you would be so calm and collected if you were ever interviewed and under pressure. If you were interviewed by the police, I think you'd be fine with it. Whereas for me, I'd be the one, they'd come knocking on the door to ask me about a burglary up the road. And I'd be like, it was me. Just take me away, even though I've done nothing wrong. But yeah, I think I could kill someone. I think our show's called Seeing Red. And, I think most of us have this, ability to, just act massively out of character if the wrong buttons are pushed. And I know that I've reacted and exploded in rage before, which is massively out of character for me. And, I think it's possible. I think people can see red and flip and massively overreact and live to regret it. So I think I'm capable for sure.
We all have our breaking points.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't cross me. And for don't some... fuck with me and it could happen.
Don't fuck with me. coughing my way through this recording. Well done, Michael. Well done. I'm going to test your morals now.
Ooh, fun. Love this.
Adolf Hitler. Okay. Notoriously a bit of a bastard. We all know that. Responsible for murder.
Major bastard.
Potentially... Major
bit of
bastard.
A naughty boy. Bit of a naughty boy.
Absolutely. Murdering millions of people. So, if you had a time machine and a gun, would you kill him as a baby? Kill him before he gets started?
Yeah. 100%.
I always struggle with things like this because I think there's so much more and there's the whole butterfly effect that potentially... at some point during his rise to power where you haven't got too many people who believe what he also believes and then will follow his lead and someone else could step in and take his place. But I feel like you need to put something in place to make sure that nobody else started to have the same ideas that he had, because he wasn't alone. So I think if you just killed him as a baby, someone else would have been Vladolf Hitler instead. So I don't think I'd do it as a baby. But later on.
Interesting, isn't it? Because it's a question that people often ask, and then you say to yourself, but what has a baby done? Baby has done nothing. It knows nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And, he did do some good paintings.
Fucking hell, Beth,
then. Jesus. Like, you don't want to lose them completely. No, I am being very blasé there. But I just think, there would be up to a certain point where would it really change history anyway? Because I feel like someone would do something anyway. And then, actually, maybe you could change history by changing his mindset somehow, or maybe you could make a difference in a different way rather than just shooting.
Or maybe it would ultimately, the kind of reality that plays out, if you did go back and kill him, it could ultimately be worse. It could be that somebody else rises to power that's twice as bad as Hitler was. It's a really difficult one. And the other thing is, could when push comes to shove, could you actually do it anyway? I don't think I could kill any baby. You're absolutely right. But yeah, theoretically, I'd like to think that I could have put a stop to what he went on to wreak across the world.
It makes you wonder whether any of us, we've all had kind of nice lives. It makes you wonder whether any of us could be the next Hitler. Like, if our lives would have gone a different way.
I do agree with that. I always say, we discuss this quite a bit on our show. I think, there but for the grace of God go I. And I don't mean that from a religious perspective. It's just that kind of saying, isn't it, that we quite often have empathy with the perpetrators in our episodes. Not always, of course, but sometimes we do have empathy with them because we can see that their life, they just didn't get the right opportunities at the right time that we perhaps did, and it put them on a different path and a path to destruction. It doesn't excuse what they did, but I'm always very lucky and grateful that I lived the life I get to live, and I didn't go on that path and make the wrong decisions, because I could have done.
Yeah, we always say this, don't we? It's there's that statistic that you're only ever 3 months away from being fully homeless as a man in the UK. It's a bit different with women because there's a lot more support, but you lose your job in the first month, and then if you don't get yourself on your feet within 3 months, most men in, like, that's the cat. Let me just shoo her out a second.
Serial killer cat.
Every serial killer has a cat.
That's true, isn't it?
Don't tell them that. I've got three.
Oh, God.
But there's that kind of statistic that you could be in a position where you're homeless, and then potentially you self-medicate with drugs or alcohol or something to deal with what you're going through, and who knows where anybody could end up 6 months down the line. It is a horrible kind of sobering thought, isn't it, to remember that, yes, that's still a horrible person who's done something awful, but thinking about maybe what took them to that point is also important.
Yeah. Bizarre. Which elements of your life would make you the best serial killer?
I think for me, doing the show, doing our podcast would be an advantage because I know what works and what doesn't work. So, for example, if I wanted to be a serial killer, usually that's pretty motiveless, and that's why they can get away with it for a long time. So I would know that not having a motive is important. We know a lot about...
You could blame someone else as well.
Somebody else, yeah.
And not having a type and then blaming it on somebody as a
Yeah, so I think that would help us. I think I probably would be pretty shit though, because I'm the opposite to Bethan in that I'm always anxious, always nervous, always worried about stuff. And that would completely make it not really practical to pursue that as a career for myself. Hence I chose to go into banking and then insurance. So I don't think I've got many qualities that would allow me to be successful.
I can only think of things that would be negatives. And so things like the fact that I've got a young family, I'd kind of have to take the kids along to a lot of things. I do. So that's not going to work very well. And also, because I've got three cats, I'm definitely going to drop a cat hair at some position in somewhere. Yeah. And then it's going to be like that case,
Mark. I was just going to say that.
Where they caught the guy because his cat's hair was found in the crime scene. So I just think there's loads of things that would stop me being good. Even though I'm cool and calm and collected,
I think the cat...
I'd get screwed over by other people. This is the problem.
I think the cat hair... honestly, Bethan, the cat hair would absolutely be your downfall. I think they would manage to get some samples of that from the crime scene and trace it right back to your cats and to you, and you'd be fucked, really. Yeah. I think I've probably got some good qualities that would help. I can be quite methodical, and maybe that would help in planning some of the killings. But also, I'm kind of scared of the dark and stuff. Like, we did an episode on the Manchester Canal Pusher. Bethan did a two-part episode on it. Brilliant episode. And we don't know if crimes were being committed, but a number of people found themselves in the Manchester Canal network over a few years, and there were lots of deaths, and potentially more so than you would get on any other canal network. So we didn't know if there was this mysterious pusher in place, and there was some horrific witness testimony of one guy was pushed into the canal, desperately trying to claw his way onto the bank, back out, and this guy stood above him and put his foot calmly on this guy's hand and kind of crushed it to stop him getting out. But my point is, I couldn't do something like that, because for me to walk along a canal at 10 o'clock at night in the dark, I'd be shitting myself. So it's just not going to happen.
Welcome to my life.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. Honestly, Mike, I couldn't do it. Kudos to you.
It's all I've got in my head now is the idea of Bethan out to go and commit a murder, and then halfway through going, oh, hang on, I need to get a babysitter.
Yeah, or like, yeah. Oh, damn these kids with me. You're asking for a, you know, glass of milk or something. I'm trying to kill someone here.
I've got to go to the toilet. Don't go to the toilet. Yes, I've got to murder this person.
Yeah, we don't want any DNA. Oh,
yeah, please don't leave your DNA around because you've learned to blow raspberries or something stupid.
So, one final question. If either of you were to find out that the other was a serial killer, what would you do?
Oh, that's a really interesting thought. I would totally take full advantage. I'd want exclusive rights to everything, but I'd also totally, like, you'd be going down, Mark, I'm sorry. I'd write to you in prison, but I'm not keeping your secret.
I think, yeah, bizarrely, I wouldn't disbelieve it if I found out that Bethan was a serial killer. So there would be an element of me that would be like, yep, the jigsaw pieces are fitting into place. So I knew this day was coming.
I'd be shocked about you.
You'd be shocked. So no, that's you, fair. I don't think I've got it in me. I could see you doing it. You're so calm and, psychotic. So, no, I'm just kidding. You're not that bad.
I feel like Mike's literally only got us on to interview us so he can split.
Honestly,
us up.
Yeah, he wants to take one of our places. I think we're quite moralistic, actually, aren't we? So we'd have to grass each other up. But I think I would relish having a friend that's a serial killer. And I, you know, I'm not diminishing from the pain that you would have wrought, and the victims and their families and all of that. That obviously goes without saying. But I'd fucking dine out on this for the rest of my entire life, that my friend is a serial killer, and I knew her really well, and yeah, that'd be my dinner party.
You'd
piece.
Be getting involved on the Netflix documentary.
Yeah, I'd sell you down the river, and I'd build a massive profile for myself off your back, and I think you'd support that, to be fair. So
yeah, no, I'd be doing the same.
And I'd be
you,
fine.
Actually. I'd be having I'd be interviewing you and then writing a book, and I'd sneak you some, like, contraband into prison, though. Yeah. I'd get you some, like, vodka or something.
Yeah, some drugs. And I'd do the same for you. So I think we'd have each other's backs, but we'd totally have to accept that we couldn't let the other get away with that. And, but we'd milk it for all it was worth, for sure. There'd be a nice six-parter episode coming up on it, wouldn't there?
I think this is amazing. We've gone from an interview where it started off with the two of you wanted to murder each other with poisoning in an abattoir.
I forgot that.
And now,
and now you've come back together and coalesced into a beautiful unit.
I think it's a weird relationship that you have to have when you, because obviously we present the show together. So, yeah, we're very different, aren't we? But weirdly, it just works for us. So I think it would work in lots of other facets of life. If one of us was a serial killer, we'd bizarrely have each other's backs, although we would still grass each other up. We'd still support each other, I'm sure.
It is a weird thought, though, isn't it? When you think about, like, potentially it's different because we're not family or related or in a relationship. So we have a working relationship and we have a business side and we have a friendship. But when it's like, what if it was your own son? That's what always freaks me out, is when people have to make a decision that in depth. I feel like there's almost no other option but to give up your friend, sadly. Sorry, Mark. But what if it's your flesh and blood? That freaks me out a little bit.
Yeah, and I honestly don't think you could answer that objectively until you're in that situation, because we've covered loads of cases where the perpetrator's mum, for example, has found out what they've been doing. Sometimes they're shocked by their own family, and other times they're massively protected by them. So it's not like a hard and fast rule for anyone that, it's family, so I'll protect them. There's that kind of nurturing desire to protect at all costs. That can go out the window quite easily when values are compromised so heavily.
I think we've learned a lot about you guys today, good and bad.
This is going to be on record forever. I mean, neither of us can now become a serial killer or kill the other, or actually, even if just one of us gets murdered, the other is going to be prime suspect. So we've fucked that up for sure.
I know. If you die and it looks like poison, they're going to be knocking on my door.
And if you ever find yourself in an abattoir, Beth, then just watch your back, yeah?
I'm not going to an abattoir.
No, don't.
Ever.
Please don't.
In my life.
No, cancel your
and
plans.
And if you invite me somewhere... If you invite me to Soho, I'm not coming.
No way. God, no.
Oh, yeah. If you do murder each other, do it in Soho, please.
We'll do
it in your patch. We couldn't think of anyone better to cover the case, so it would have to be around Soho.
I'll make you guys sound great.
Perfect. I'm happy with
that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Brill. So, thank you, guys. Your podcast is Seeing Red. Where do people find this?
They can find it wherever.
Anywhere,
yeah, anywhere
really.
they listen to their podcasts. We're on Spotify and whatever the rest of them are called. So, yeah, just search Seeing Red, a true crime podcast, and you'll find us.
We release every Wednesday, so they can come and have... They've got loads of back issues as well. We're up to season 7.
Oh, what I would say, crazy. The only thing I'd say is I'd encourage anyone to start at the more recent episodes, because we were pretty shit back in the day, weren't we?
We like to say that we recorded on a potato. It's that bad sound quality. I used to sit in a cupboard and record on my phone. So, definitely listen to more recent episodes first. And then if you like us, you could probably put up with the terrible sound quality.
Great. Thank you so much for coming, guys. It's been a pleasure to talk with
you. Thank you for having us, Mike.
Thank you for having us. Bye.
Lots of love.
Bye.
Bye. There you go. How was that? Did you enjoy that? Bit of fun? Check out Seeing Red. Really good UK and international based true crime podcast. Mark and Bethan are really lovely people as well. I'm sure, I know most of you already listen to Murdermile, listen to Seeing Red as well. So give them a go. Give them a go. I'll pop a link in the show notes. Remind me to do that. I'll put a link in the show notes. But if not, just type in Seeing Red. There you go. So... Hope you enjoyed that episode. Let's make a couple of tea. Let's make a nice cup of tea. Oh, dear Lord. let's not do a regular tea. I'm going to do... what am I going to do? I'm going to do one of these herbal teas. An herbal tea. Nice. Open some windows. Oh, God. I can't hear anything out of these ears. Which means I can't hear Eva shouting at me going, where's my cocktail? Because it's, what time is it now? Just gone 12:30. I mean, she'll be coming out of a post-booze slumber. She'll be shouting in a bit. There'll be puke down the top. As always, you know what she's like. So, yeah, that's on the go.
Good. This is all going good. What's going on in my little crappy little world? Oh, welcome to Extra Mile. I should say that. New listeners, this is Extra Mile. Unscripted, unedited. We do some quiz questions in a bit. I tell you more about the case. I haven't put it into my notes. I'm an idiot. I forgot to do that. I'll do that in a second. So, what's going on in my world? I was meant to be at hospital today to get my eyes checked out because I've had a month of where the whites of my eyes have been bright red. Like my eyes developed an infection. I've had it for a long time. And it got to the point where I couldn't put my new contact lenses in. And I was like, oh no, there's nothing worse. That means I've got to go back to the old lenses, which were quite painful. So I was meant to be in hospital today getting that sorted. And I was like, oh, this is going to be months of agony. But I got a really good eye specialist. And in advance, he said, before you come and see me, I want you to do all of these different things. And it turned out I've had a reaction to one of my lens solutions. Solution toxicity, he said. So I changed out that lens and now my eyes are fine, which is great. I take pictures of my eyes every day to check that they're okay and they're good. So everything is good. I think I come out of COVID isolation tomorrow. That's my day to escape. Whether I've had COVID or not, I don't know. I said this last week. Some people seem to get it really badly. I'm fully vaccinated and fully boosted and all that. And I isolate properly and I wear a mask and I sanitize my hands. I do everything properly, as you should still. I think we should all still have a level of security about us. As they do in Japan. Do you know, when they have a cold, they wear masks. Why haven't we developed that? To protect other people from just simple things like colds, which is still one of the biggest killers. Still no cure for it. It's amazing that we don't live in our society where we don't, you know. Do you know when people have a cold at work and they go, oh, don't worry, I made it in. And they get the sympathy vote. And it's just like, I hate those people. They're just like the wankers who spread colds everywhere. I think we should all start wearing masks when we're going to feel a cold coming on. That should be standard for all of us now. But, no, we've all decided that masks were only a temporary thing. I'm still wearing mine in the shops. And people look at you and go, oh, why are you wearing a mask? Boris has said you don't have to wear a mask. Therefore, he sent a letter to the virus and the virus said, okay, I won't infect people anymore. I'm going to wear a mask. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. I'd rather not infect other people, especially as I have relatives who are unwell and I don't want to make them sick, and I'd love to go and visit them. What else is going on? Still on my diet. I'm on that final bit as before, where kind of the bulk of the weight has come off, but I'm still struggling to get rid of the final bit. Oh, still a bit fat. Have putting cake back into my diet. And last week I tried out one of these free from cakes. Do you know the ones that are like free from eggs, free from wheat? And it was like a sponge. And I thought, oh, this is going to be horrible. But I tried it and they were really nice. I was really impressed. And because no one likes them, they were going really cheap as well. So, yeah, nice. Five little slices, though, are very nice. What else is going on? Live shows. We're doing live shows. Tickets available in the show notes. We've got the first one going up in Glasgow end of June. So that one's organised by Adam at UK True Crime, who we're doing the show with. Paul of True Crime Enthusiast, who we're also doing the show with, he's organising one over in kind of Liverpool area, Liverpool or Manchester area, and I'm going to be organising one in kind of August, September time in London. So we've got some extra shows coming up, only one available ticket-wise at the moment, where the rest we're kind of sorting out, but that is moving ahead, so that'll be very exciting. Thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Sarah Lear Month, Karen Burns, and Liz Dakin. Thank you, all three. That's very kind of you. Thank you for becoming Patreon supporters. Hope you enjoy all the secret goodies that are in Patreon that no one else gets. No one else gets. The videos get released like a week later into the world, and my special little videos are kind of there as well. But Walk With Me doesn't get released anywhere, and the secret, the special crime scene photos, they never get released. I don't release them into the world. They stay on Patreon. So if you want to see things that you won't see anywhere else, join the Patreon group. Nice people, and it's good fun. Right, let's do some quiz questions while I have a slurp of my herbally tea, which was it's one with licorice. Very nice. Very nice. Question number one. What did Samuel Bragg's dad do as a job? So what job did Samuel Bragg's dad do? Question number two. What did actor Kevin Klein shout on the corner of Randolph Avenue? It was one word, and if you want, you could shout it right now. Question number three. What size was Samuel Bragg's room? Question four. What did he steal every morning from outside Mr. Rosen's door? Question five. How did Kathleen guess that old Samuel was seriously ill? Question six. What did Timothy spend the 3 shillings on? Question seven. What was Timothy buying when he stole the 3 shillings off his mum? Question eight. What's the nearest murder so far to this specific case, as mentioned at the start of the episode? Question nine. What hospital was Samuel sent to when he was ill in 1962? Number 10, what two jobs do we know that Samuel did? Right, let's dive into some details. Normally I pop these into a nice little bundle afterwards so I can look at them, but I forgot to do it today. So what do we know about Samuel? We know that he moved in March 1955 into the flat. He's pretty much a recluse. He paid 14 shillings 10 pence per week. It was a council run lodging. It's very nice and posh now, but back then it's amazing, all these houses, especially in West London, which are council run tenements, and many of them were like ready to be demolished, and then people were like, oh, actually no, these are nice buildings, we'll keep them. And they, you know, I was looking at one of the buildings on Randolph Avenue yesterday, and in late 1999, So 1999, late end of the last century. One of these flats was worth, I think it was like £130,000. Today, just 20 years later, over £1 million. It's ridiculous. No one can afford to live in houses anymore unless you already own a house, or you gifted it, or you've got an inheritance, or you bought it later on. I've no idea. It's hard to do that now. And God knows, for like the children who are born today, God knows how they're going to be able to afford to live in houses if the prices are going up at a ridiculous rate. It's ridiculous, it really is. What else we got? Let's have a look. Let's dive through here. Timothy Noel Cotter, 14 years old, born in 1949. He was a schoolboy, he was healthy, wore glasses. As mentioned, he had a bit of a squint to his eye. Family are Irish. Originally, I'd prepared to do a nice Irish accent for Kathleen, but I couldn't get it to work on the day, so I did a kind of a country one. Who cares? It kind of works anyway, doesn't it? They'd lived there for 12 years. Timothy Sr. was the father. He was a respectable working class man, a builder's foreman. Anthony, who was a year older, shared a bunk bed with Timothy on top. Jean Eleanor was the younger daughter. She was 12 years old. She lived there as well. And they had an older sister who was already married and had moved out by that point. By all accounts, they were very much a unified and an affectionate family. They were very close. Timothy attended a Roman Catholic primary school where he passed his 11 plus. And then he went to the Central Foundation Grammar School for Boys over in EC2, which is kind of Holborn-y area. He was dismissed in April 1964 for not working hard enough. And he now attended, by that point, he was now attending a secondary modern school in Marylebone. Now, April 1964 is kind of significant. We'll try and dive into some of these details in a bit, because there's more that... Scroll down. Let me try and find these details. The robbery. The previous robbery that had gone on. Where was it? Timothy would admit that he'd stolen £26 from old Samuel. He got into his room. He got the keys. He got into the box. So he'd actually done this all before. Kathleen didn't want her son to get a criminal record. So she took him to a probation officer. And they agreed that in order to deal with this without going to the police, that If Timothy paid back the money over a period of weeks, then that would be fine. That would be acceptable. Which is kind of, in a way, that's kind of nice. Sometimes you don't want a child to get a criminal record. Sometimes you want to say, you need to pay back the money. This is how you're going to make amends. And it's interesting with Timothy, he does, it seems in a way like he is a kind of a good boy at heart, but he's just going through a difficult time, or, you know, teenage years. He seems to be getting in with a bad crowd. You know, his mother's kind of struggling to look after him. So, but he's a good boy. He seems to get quite upset about things, but yeah, times are a-changing, unfortunately. This is why I like to have my details all kind of in one place, because then I could just look at it and go, ah, there we go. He confessed to a local boy, a friend of his, described as a blonde boy called Kenneth Rogers. He was hanging out with Kenneth just before this. Noisy seagulls. Just before the murder took place, they'd met up, they'd gone out on bikes together, they'd gone to the kind of the youth club around the corner. And Timothy would say, I left him before I did the job. So he would later refer to the robbery and the murder as the job. For some reason, he seems to make reference to Samuel. He calls him Polly. He does it a couple of times. It seems to be his nickname, and we've no idea why he does it. Now, I've alluded slightly to it in there. Samuel was never married. He didn't have kids. Timothy seems to have issues. The further you go into his back history, he seems to have a lot of issues with homosexual men. He seems to have a dislike for homosexual men, and as mentioned in the thing, he mentions about how he would beat them up and how he would stab them with lit cigarettes. Whether Samuel was homosexual, we don't know, but it seems interesting that he calls him Polly, but we don't know why. He doesn't have a parrot. That was kind of one idea that I thought it could be, but there doesn't seem to be a reason, and no one seems to express why. So whether there was something in the past going on between Timothy and Samuel, that's just conjecture. There's nothing in there to say that it was happening, or we don't know. We really don't know. So, yeah. Immediately, as mentioned in the episode, a lot of the tenants in the house, even though Samuel's room was messy, they all felt that there was something wrong with there. Montague Rosen, who was on the first floor, was terribly upset and said there's something wrong with Mr. Bragg. But he said that when he looked in the room was a mess, but said the room was never looked anything like this before. The kind of, some of the drawers were open and things were moved. It was messy, but it was not as messy as it normally is. What else have we got? As mentioned, Kathleen said old Samuel has been done in. That was her exact words to the police. They said there were bruises and they couldn't work out how he'd got his bruises, because he'd been bedbound for about 3 weeks. First officer turned up. That was PC Horace Sims. Police turned up. They pretty much went through everything. When you look at it, it's kind of, if you think about it, nothing had been stolen. Old man lying in his bed. Bruises, which you'd expect with an old man. He'd got a pillow, not over his face, but to the side of his face. Everyone agreed he got breathing issues. He wasn't particularly strong. There didn't seem to be signs of assault. So you can understand why they would say it wasn't a robbery. It wasn't a robbery because nothing was nicked, except for the pair of keys, which no one noticed. But then again, why would you? Why would you? If someone came in and broke into my boat and I was found dead, would someone? I have keys on my belt as well. Would someone notice whether my keys were there or not? I think it's highly unlikely. They would probably find the other keys that I have in the room and they'd go, oh, well, this is his keys. But it's not. It's not the keys I normally use. So, yeah, two of the drawers were open, one wasn't, and that was the one that was locked. He'd got the keys, but we don't know why he couldn't open the box. He couldn't open the box and he couldn't open the drawer, so we don't know why. He must have panicked and been struggling. Let's go down to... If you go... There was a palm print found on a chair in Samuel's room at the time, and they couldn't identify whose it was. Could just be a mistake. Could have been one of the policemen. And it wasn't ruled out, so we don't know. As mentioned, the body was taken away by J.H. Kenyon, the undertakers of Westbourne Grove, and was taken to St. Pancras Mortuary. The autopsy was pretty standard. They said he was, as always, they always start with the phrase, he was well nourished. People always hate that. It's like, it seems to be tradition that you, if you're a pathologist, you have to open with the statement whether someone was well nourished or not. They said his body was unkempt and his eyes were sunken. He was wearing a soiled grey shirt and long pants. These were kind of his pyjamas. Rigor mortis had set in on the skin over his left-hand side, the left arm and the back of his trunks. He had tiny hemorrhages to his eyelids and cyanosis to the fingers. So rigor mortis had set in. They reckoned he'd been dead, I think they said about 12 to 16 hours, which puts his time of death at around the time that Timothy would have come back from the youth club. But they're still uncertain about that. Originally they thought it was asphyxiation by smothering, which was consistent because it was, he had a, it wasn't, I've put pillow in the episode, but actually it was a bolster, but I just didn't want to have to go through the episode explaining what a bolster was. A bolster is basically just a slightly longer pillow that normally you would put, if you're a couple, you'd put it between you so you've got a bit of a space, or you'd use it as kind of something to balance you up while, if you sleep on your side, but that's really just what it was. What else we got? Let's go down. Let me try and find those details about Timothy. Couple of interesting things in his back history. So obviously we mentioned about the theft before. So he'd stolen money from previous times. He'd stolen money to buy, I can't remember if this was a question, who cares, to buy fashionable clothes so he could hang out with new pals. And he said that he started to enjoy dances. So he was stealing to get money to go off to dances. He seemed to still be doing his paper round, of which he was earning £1 a week. But then again, £1 is 20 shillings. 10 of those shillings went to old Samuel. 10 for himself, although I believe that some of it went to his mum as well. So he probably only had about 5 shillings, which wasn't enough if you were a young lad and you want to have a bit of fun. He was absent from school March 1964, reported missing. Apparently he had an argument with his father after he threw an electric light bulb from a railway carriage. He returned home the next day, having spent the night in a loft in a nearby building. So after that, he was dismissed from his grammar school, which is a slightly posher school, and then he had to go to a secondary modern, which is not so posh. I went to a secondary modern, no wrong with that. 14th of June 1964, 1 month before the murder, he ran away from home again, this time with 2 boys. He was found at Dover, so on the south coast, on the 18th of June and was returned home. He was playing truant from the grammar school as he was unhappy there. He admits on occasions he was frightened of his father. 9th of April 1963, so this is around the same time, just before he went truant. He fell from his bike and sustained a small head injury. He was sent to St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington and was detained overnight for observation. He was conscious but confused when admitted and diagnosed with an abrasion to the right-hand side of the forehead and right wrist. He had no internal injuries or damage to the skull. He was discharged on the 10th but failed to keep a further appointment at the hospital. By all accounts, a regular lad who liked playing football at Paddington Rec with his pals. He goes to record shops and attends meetings of the local Sea Cadets. He had no illness as a child and no history of insanity in the family. His mother said that he'd been hanging out with kind of older boys, different boys than what he was used to, who had their fashionable hairstyles and bad language. So obviously this is the 60s, you've kind of got the teddy boy era has gone and we're kind of moving into the mods and the rockers phase at this point. So Kenneth Rogers, his mate, he was the one he originally confessed to, but it doesn't seem to be a confession. It seems to be a bit of bragging that's going on. And he said that he got into Samuel's room, was going through his things, and Samuel woke him, and he woke Samuel up by mistake. Timothy said to him that he ran out, and he did not think the old man saw him, which was obviously a lie, because he later changed that in his confession. A few minutes later, Timothy said to Kenneth Rogers, "Do you know the old man's dead now?" And that's pretty much all they had on that. But he did say the crafty old man had £50 in his mattress and a post office book with £2,000 in it. Now, this was said on the 18th of July, so this was before he gave his confession. So he knew, he's already admitted that he knew of all that money. What else is there? Inquest was opened on the 24th of July at St Pancras Coroner's Court, and it was adjourned until the 31st of July, as is standard. There was a committal hearing at Marylebone East Juvenile Court in Seymour Place on the 7th of August 1964, and he was charged with murder in furtherance of a theft. Now, this is kind of key, because 1964... we've still got the death penalty. It's already on the cards that it's going to be coming off, but we're still at that point where if you commit a murder, you will be sent to a life in prison. But if you commit murder in the furtherance of a theft, meaning you're stealing something and then you killed someone, that is a death sentence. So it's kind of important for him at this point, because even though he's only 14 years old, he could still be executed for this. So he pleads manslaughter. At that point, the jury said they found it difficult to find that a boy of 14-year-old intended to kill or to do grievous bodily harm. At this point, he was committed to Brixton Prison, and he was awaiting his trial at the Old Bailey. As mentioned, Dr. P.D. Scott, who we've had before of Maudsley Hospital, assessed him while he was being held at HM Remand Centre in Ashford. He said the boy is of superior intelligence. His intelligence quotient, his IQ, is 129. I think the average is 98. He shows no confusion or thought disorder of any kind. He does display a certain callousness towards his victim. He is rather childish in his outlook, although some of his tastes are more sophisticated than would be expected from a 14-year-old boy. He stole to feed his new tastes, such as mentioned, dancing and records. At times he gives the impression of indifference to his situation, perhaps trying to conceal the seriousness of his position. In general, he is polite and cooperative. He displays no sympathies which require treatment, and his condition does not indicate that he should be dealt with under the Mental Health Act. He shows no evidence of mental illness. He had regarded the offence largely because of its implications. He had regretted the offence largely because of its implications to himself rather than because of the sympathy for the victim. And as mentioned earlier on, the only hint of violence is his fantasy and his description of how you would deal with homosexual men in cinemas. He said, I would slam them or stub them with cigarettes. I think that's pretty much it. Mentioned, tried at the Old Bailey, the Central Criminal Court. This is what attracted me to the story. I can't remember how I found it, but it was through a small article originally, and I think I went searching for manslaughter Maida Vale. I went searching for it, and I found just an article about him, a 14-year-old boy in court, no emotion, no remorse at all, and I was like, oh, I need to know more about that story. I think originally the newspapers had said that he'd murdered his brother in bed. As always, the press always get things wrong because they can't be asked to check the details. It turned out to be a 77-year-old neighbour. Entirely different, but there you go. That's newspapers for you. I think that's it. Yeah. I mean, in court, he said, I went into the room to get some money as I had spent some of my mother's change. I was looking in the drawers. When he woke up, I panicked and threw the pillow over his head. he keeps saying he threw it, and then he says he held it. So the judge made an order for him to be held in prison for 10 years and said that the Home Secretary might release him on licence long before that period. As mentioned, he was held at Stamford House Remand Centre, which is currently under investigation for child abuse at the moment, and where he boasted about his escapades having killed a man, and he had to be separated from the other boys. We know no other details about Timothy Cotter after this point. I have searched. He just seems to have vanished. He's certainly still alive, because there's no death certificate there, and he wouldn't have been that old. Probably be in his... Born 1949, so yeah, he'd be mid-70s by now. So, one thing that doesn't make sense to me, he said he stole money from Samuel to pay back the 3 shillings he owed his mum. But he earns £1 a week, which is 20 shillings, on his paper round. So, even if he's given back 10 shillings a week to Samuel, and even if he's given back five shillings to his mum to kind of, you know, pay for food and things like that, if he is indeed doing that, still has 5 shillings. So why does he need to steal money from old Samuel to pay back the 3 shillings? Doesn't make sense. Anyway, let's dive into this. Right, quiz questions, some of which I may have ballsed up. I don't know. Question one. What job did Samuel Bragg's dad do? He was a sawdust dealer. Got to be... People sell sawdust. You got to be a sawdust dealer. Question two. What did actor Kevin Kline shout on the corner of Randolph Avenue? The line from A Fish Called Wanda is, "Asshole!" Which every time I go past Randolph Avenue, I always shout, "Asshole!" Question three. What size was Samuel Bragg's room? It's 15 feet square. I went past there the other day. I think it's been converted not into flats, but back into being a big house again. It's very posh. And there was someone in the front room staring at me because I was filming it. They were like, "Oh, he looks like a scoundrel. He looks like a burglar." Yeah. Question four. What did Samuel steal every morning from outside Mr. Rosen's door? It was his newspaper. Given the fact that he would have gone into the toilet afterwards for 20 minutes and he was abluting and tipping his bucket of shit and piss down the toilet, I seriously wouldn't want to read that newspaper afterwards. Question five. How did Kathleen guess that old Samuel was seriously ill? The toilet was clean. Must have been the right state. Question six. What did Timothy spend the 3 shillings on? He spent it on pinball. Question seven. What was Timothy buying when he stole the 3 shillings off his mum? Bread and milk. Question eight. What's the nearest murder so far to this case? This was the old murder of Hannah Brown, whose torso was found just around the corner when that road, Randolph Avenue, was being built. But the head was found in East London. We covered that ages ago. Question nine. What hospital was Samuel sent to when he was ill in 1962? Same one that Timothy was sent to when he injured his head. It was St. Mary's. And question 10, St. Mary's, which is also where Dr. Spilsbury got his training. And question 10, what 2 jobs do we know that Samuel did? We know that he was a labourer and he was a soldier during World War I. Whew. So there we go, folks. That's that. Oh, I'm going to rest my voice. My voice is screwed. Sore. Really sore today. So I hope you enjoyed that. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe. Thank you for listening to Murdermile. If you enjoy Murdermile, tell your friends. Tell them you like it. Share it on social media. That always helps. Always gets the word out into the ether and people go, "Oh, I like that. I will listen to that as well." That would be much appreciated. Anyway, have yourself a good week. Stay safe, be good, lots of love. Bye bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations?
Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.